This is actually an important lecture today. It's the second part of our two-part treatment of the Kennedy period. Absolutely fundamental importance in terms of the history of the Cold War and also for the light it sheds on all these issues that we're concerned with in our class. Why is it so important? The title of the lecture today, Fourth Chance for Peace, that's what sums it up. We're trying to understand the Cold War. Our approach is to look at these various points in the history of the post-war period when it seemed that a stable peace was on the verge of coming into being. When both of the major powers, the United States and the Soviet Union, seemed to be on the verge of agreeing on the sort of system that would allow them to kind of get along with each other without a war, without even a serious crisis, right? And we looked at 1945, we looked at 1949, we looked at 1954. All of these different points in the history of the period, it seemed that, well, you know, America and Russia could accept a sort of arrangement where the two sides could kind of live with each other in peace. And in none of those cases did it work. And the question of, well, why didn't it work, lies at the heart of the analysis of what the Cold War is about. Why don't you just leave that there? Okay. Why didn't it work? Because one side or the other are just so committed to their own ideology that they can't get along with each other? No, that's not what it's about. You know, what's so striking about this story, and indeed about international politics in general, is the way power realities discipline political objectives. Oh, yeah, well, on some basic abstract level, we'd love to see democracy spread around the world and so on, but we're not going to pursue that goal to the point of war. Soviets make the same sort of argument in reverse. It's not ideological in that sense. It's only when kind of a fundamental power political interest comes into play that you have problems. And what is that interest? It's really only one exception to this general rule about how the two sides could get along with each other, namely, each controls things on its side of the line of demarcation. And that has to do with Germany, because the Soviets cannot allow the Western powers to have a free hand to do whatever they want in the part of Germany they control, you know, the most important part of the country, Western Germany. Right? And so the question of whether a stable peace can come into being is whether the Western powers among themselves are able to create a permanent, viable political system which would keep German power in check. And in a nuclear age, that means one and only one thing. The core issue is West Germany going to have nuclear weapons under her own control? Is the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, going to have a finger on the nuclear trigger or not? Because if West Germany goes nuclear, that's bound to pose a fundamental threat to the USSR's control of East Germany, Eastern Europe in general. It's bound to raise the risk of things escalating to the level of a general war, not right away, but at some point down the road to the point where the Soviets would, you know, feel that their most fundamental political interests in Europe are at stake. Right? But the problem is, what are the Germans supposed to do? Not go nuclear at all? Trust their security to the United States? You know. Well, there are all these problems with that. You know, countries want control over their own destiny. They don't want to be treated as wards or satellites of other countries, especially a country that had been a major power. Yeah. Can you trust the Americans to defend them? Well, maybe now you can, with a big American army in Europe and the Soviets relatively weak in terms of their nuclear capability, because don't forget, thanks to the big American military buildup of the early 1950s, the United States had, by the end of the Truman period, late 52, had achieved this degree of nuclear superiority over the Soviets so that, you know, if a war broke out, the USSR would just be totally destroyed as a functioning society. Ended, whereas the United States, maybe even Western Europe as well, would get off essentially scot-free. That's nuclear superiority. You know, if the Soviets mess around with West Germany or West Berlin, you can threaten nuclear escalation. They're bound to kind of, you know, throw in the towel because they can't risk a war given that fundamental strategic reality. That's the strategic reality. You know, for the mid-50s, it's gradually declines in the late Eisenhower period. And people realize it's going to end in the not-too-distant future. Well, how are you going to defend West Germany when America no longer has the upper hand in strategic terms? We can't threaten nuclear escalation because it's suicidal. No one will believe us. Right? Don't the Germans need nuclear weapons under their own control? Very common argument. Very powerful argument. It's not because countries have, you know, West Germany had aggressive goals that under Adenauer the Germans wanted to develop a nuclear force under their own control. It's because it's for defensive reasons. How are you going to stand up to a great nuclear power like the Soviets when you're essentially unable to defend yourself and you can't count on your great protector from across the ocean to defend you, right? And this, for Eisenhower, is not a problem. Eisenhower doesn't think that the United States should have to defend Europe forever. He feels the Europeans should be able to kind of defend themselves. And for a variety of reasons, and I discussed the three great taproots of the Eisenhower policy, the American government during the 1950s, in the Eisenhower period, embraces this policy of what was called nuclear sharing. Nuclear sharing means letting the NATO allies have control of nuclear weapons. A lot of them are American nuclear weapons, both tactical and ultimately strategic nuclear weapons. The Europeans are also going to be encouraged, especially if they get together and do this on a multinational basis, to develop a kind of nuclear infrastructure which would allow them to produce these weapons on their own without having to depend on the United States to provide them. Right? So by the end of the Eisenhower period, you have the Europeans, including the Germans, having de facto control of nuclear weapons. The fact that we're moving in that direction is the central taproot driving Soviet policy. It's how the Great Berlin Crisis that begins in November of 1958 is to be understood. Right? And this is a real crisis, much more so than the Berlin blockade affair of 1948-49. This great Berlin crisis, 58-62, the central episode of the Cold War. Very, very important, right? Because it forces the Western powers to take Soviet concerns about Germany seriously. You know, you just move ahead, we'll cut off Berlin, that's going to raise the risk of war. You want a war? Right. Under Eisenhower, no solution. Eisenhower is not, you know, eager for a war or anything like that, or taking advantage of American nuclear superiority to humiliate the Soviets, as would have been possible, because he knows that the American edge is going to last forever. And yeah, we can get our way now, but this situation is not stable. We got to change it. We got to reach some sort of settlement over West Berlin. West Berlin is our Achilles heel. We can't abandon it, and yet it's a big source of vulnerability for us. So we want to settle it. We want to settle it at a time when we're relatively strong, because the terms we could hope to get are going to be better. That's the basic Eisenhower thinking. It leads to all these efforts that are made to kind of reach a deal. And they're flexible, but on all of these secondary issues, like, are you going to allow the East German police to stamp the travel documents on the way to Berlin? Things like that. Yeah, West Germans think, oh, no, you shouldn't allow that because it gives recognition to the legitimacy of East Germany. We don't want to do that because it compromises the our belief in the importance of ultimately achieving a unified German state. Yeah, Eisenhower and the other Western governments, the British, the French, they view that as a lot of nonsense, stuffiness, they call it, right? They're willing to kind of be compromising on those kind of issues, but on the one core issue, namely nuclear sharing, both the Eisenhower administration and the Adenauer government, Konrad Adenauer is the great chancellor of West Germany during this period, that's the one area in which they're unwilling to make any compromises at all, right? So the Berlin crisis is not settled under Eisenhower. People are afraid when it becomes clear that the attempted and negotiated solution has failed, when the Khrushchev basically walks out of the Paris summit in May of 1960 after the U-2 incident. People think, oh, well, the Soviets are going to bring this to a head again. Given that there's no negotiation, they're going to follow through on their threats to Berlin. What choice do they have, given how public these threats were? In fact, nothing of the sort. The Berlin crisis is put on the back burner because the Soviets aren't interested in provoking a very sharp crisis that could lead to war, not given their strategic position. Put on the back burner under Eisenhower. January of 1961, a new American government comes to power in Washington. The Kennedy administration, very different from Eisenhower in its fundamental approach to these issues. Right? And the Soviets are not slow to test the Kennedy policy on Berlin. They make it clear they're going to kind of renew their efforts to kind of push the West into a negotiation by making these new, by renewing their threats about Berlin. Okay? What's the Kennedy policy and how does it differ from Eisenhower's? One fundamental difference has to do with these twin issues of how strong are you going to allow the Germans to become? And is the United States going to remain in Europe on an indefinite basis? You understand why those are connected issues, right? Because if the Germans become strong, in other words, if they become a nuclear power, if they develop a substantial nuclear capability that could ride out a Soviet tank, so on, they could defend themselves. German power could balance Soviet power on its own without the need for direct American involvement. So we can withdraw. On the other hand, if we are saying to the Germans, no, you can't go nuclear, then they say, well, who's going to defend us? It's like there's only one way. You have to make sure the United States is in so that whether we want to or not, the mere presence of our troops there is going to create an automatic risk of escalation, and the threat that matters will get out of hand would be enough to deter the Soviets. So if Germany is to remain non-nuclear, the Americans have to stay in. Plus, this whole NATO system, of which U.S. military power is the backbone, right? This serves as a framework within which German power can be contained. So it's a source of reassurance to the Russians and to the Germans as well, without it being a threat to either of them, right? You want a stable system in the absence of, a strong Germany, the Americans have to stay in. Well, on those two interrelated points, the Kennedy policy is directly the opposite of Eisenhower's. Eisenhower was willing to say, Germans should be allowed to develop a nuclear capability. You can't be prejudiced against them. It's like, they were a problem in the past, but that was because Russia's weak. Now as Russia's strong, Germany won't be a problem. We should allow them to become strong. We should allow them to defend themselves. Kennedy, like most people in the American government, and certainly in the Western governments outside of Germany, and in fact, even inside of Germany, about half the Germans felt this way. the basic notion was, no, that you can't trust the Germans. They shouldn't be allowed to go nuclear. Look at their behavior. And then, you know, World War I, World War II. It's like, you know, plus there's the whole problem of, you know, what will they do when they become strong? You know, when they're weak, they're locked into the status quo power policy because they're dependent on status quo powers like the rest of NATO. When Germany becomes strong, you know, the mere strength of West Germany is going to encourage the East Germans to kind of rise up against their communist overlords, and then West Germany will be strong enough to intervene to support an insurrection there, and matters, you know, one thing could lead to another, you could have a war, and the Soviets understand this sort of thing, so when they see Germany going nuclear, that'll kind of provoke them, and you're running the risk of war. All these problems having to do with the German nuclear capability are enough to convince Kennedy and his top advisors, no, we can't permit this. Is absolutely fundamental, basic to the Kennedy policy. No German nuclear weapons. I should say that there's a whole other aspect to this having to do with the nature of our political system. These Kennedy people, they had no idea what the Eisenhower policy was. Eisenhower policy was not overt. It couldn't be overt because it was against the law. The Atomic Energy Act said, no, you couldn't allow foreigners to get control of American nuclear weapons. They were doing an end run around that law. So they had no interest in publicizing it, right? And so then the Kennedy people come in, they have no idea what the Eisenhower policy is. They have better things to do with their time than to go back into the archives and to try and sort this thing out. I mean, this is a problem you have over and over again with the change of administrations in the United States. Well, you know, we'll see it. We'll see it again when we deal with later Cold War, and especially the Reagan policy. No idea what the Kissinger-Nixon policy was. You know, you confront this over and over again. So the Kennedy people don't think that they're changing anything much. Sure, this has been our policy all along. We never want new countries to go nuclear. Non-proliferation is this terrible thing. Incidentally, the very term non-proliferation, it's a loaded term, right? The word proliferation has this notion, this is something bad. You compare it with nuclear sharing, the term that was used in the 90s, this is something good. If you actually look at the rhetoric, you see that there was this very brief period in time, the year 1960, when they actually used neutral language, like spread of nuclear weapons, diffusion of nuclear weapons. No, but they went from basically, helping our allies, with nuclear sharing. That's a good thing under Eisenhower. Now, from 1961 on, proliferation is this very bad thing by definition. You know, the language reflects the change in the thinking. So they want to keep Germany non-nuclear, and the whole notion of spread of nuclear weapons, proliferation is a terrible problem. This is an effective bludgeon that they can use to keep the Germans in line without discriminating against them too overtly. I'll be coming back to this point. The Kennedy concept. If you're not going to allow Germany to go nuclear, it's the most obvious thing in the world that the Americans have no choice but to remain in Europe. Not because we want to be this big imperial power, but we can't allow the Soviets to take over the entire continent of Europe. And there has to be a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. The Europeans can't provide it. Then the only country that can provide it is the United States. So we're stuck there. We're trapped in Europe, right? There's no purely European solution to the European security problem. America has to stay in, right? If we pull out, what's the problem? It's the whole security dilemma comes into play. Soviet power inevitably threatens Western Europe, whether it wants to or not. That means the Europeans, especially the Germans, would have to take countermeasures, which the Soviets would view as threatening, and so on and so on. You're off with the spiral. The only way of blunting the security dilemma, or to kind of cushion that problem, is to interpose American power between Germany and the Soviet Union. Right? They're not thinking in these terms. They don't use terms like security dilemma, but they have the sense that we have to stay in Europe if we're going to tell the Germans, no, you can't acquire nuclear weapons. Okay? So we're in. And if we're in, and we're putting our own heads on the chopping block, right? If matters get out of hand, it's our own cities that are going to be at risk. Then we have the right to not just remain passive and let the Europeans choose their own policies. We have the right and indeed the obligation to set policy for the West as a whole. Kennedy people in this regard are much more assertive than Eisenhower ever was. Eisenhower in the United States is this kind of mediator. We want to kind of, you know, make sure that the Germans, the British, the French, everybody kind of buy onto the common strategy. We don't want to impose our will. Under Kennedy, it's like, we have to decide the policy for the West as a whole. All the decisions should be made in Washington. We can't just allow matters to drift. And why? Because they know that America's window of opportunity is closing. Again, this is not a term they use. But they know that America's nuclear edge, which still exists in the early Kennedy period, is wasting away quite rapidly, and they see the end of American nuclear superiority in the not-too-distant horizon. We can date these things much more precisely than you might think. America's nuclear edge essentially ends in the summer of 1963, just right before Kennedy was assassinated. Summer of 1963, how do we know that? Because Kennedy was briefed by the organ within the government that was set up to analyze these things. It was called the Net Evaluation Subcommittee of the National Security Council. He was briefed on this stuff in September of 1963, and we have the records of that briefing. And basically it's, no matter how fast the United States acts, no matter how hard it strikes, the Soviets will still have enough left over to ride out that attack and go on to retaliate in such a way that it would destroy the United States as a functioning society. Okay? This is it's quite extraordinary. And they know it's coming. And given that they know it's coming, that means that they gotta act. We don't want to just kick the ball down the road on Berlin. We got to reach a settlement. And from the word go, practically, Kennedy has this notion that there's no reason why we shouldn't reach a settlement. Okay? Our interests and those of the Soviets overlap to a point where it's insane for this conflict to continue. A conflict that involves a risk of a general thermonuclear war, which would be by far the greatest tragedy in human history. It's like kind of on a par with these, prehistoric extinctions before they even were human beings. It would be such a great catastrophe. And so Kennedy presented himself. There's another problem with the American political system. We have our official ideology in this country, right? And Kennedy presented himself in his famous inaugural speeches, we will bear any burden, we will pay any price to secure the success of liberty, all this kind of overblown ideological rhetoric. You look at the documents, you listen to the Kennedy tapes, that's not the real Kennedy at all. This guy is a cool customer. He thinks in power political terms. There's all this moralistic rhetoric. You have to use it because it's expected of you, and you're kind of pandering to the public, and you have to operate in the domestic political system. But on the really important matters, he's pursuing a realistic, hard-boiled power political policy. Right? And his goal is to meet with Khrushchev and work things out. Two major powers relating to each other on the basis of their power, on a business-like basis, with each respecting the other's core political interests. On that basis, putting ideology aside, you could work things out. You can reach an understanding that would provide the basis for a relatively stable international order, so you wouldn't have to worry about war, right? The threat of war. And so, in large part as a result of these initiatives, Kennedy meets with Khrushchev at Vienna in June of 1961. And he lays out his plan, his thinking. And basically, it's, you know, we're willing to respect your, you know, your most important interests. We understand your concerns about West Germany, and he, you know, implies pretty clearly we're going to keep West Germany non-nuclear. And we understand, you know, your political position in Eastern Europe, and this is a vital interest for you, that you want to maintain your control over Eastern Europe. We understand that, too. But in exchange for that, we want something from you. We want you to relate to us in the same way. Right? We want you to respect our most fundamental interests, which is our position in Western Europe, which is very much bound up with our position in West Berlin. If we capitulate over West Berlin, we walk away with our tail between our legs, who's, you know, our whole political position in Europe is going to collapse. Right? Our promises to protect Western Europe no longer credible because of all the promises we had made about Berlin. Right? And if our position in Western Europe collapses and Western Europe drifts into neutralism or worse, then our position in the world as a whole is going to collapse. We can't accept it. You wouldn't accept it. We can't accept it either. So let's have this deal, right? It's like every reason to think the Soviets would accept this deal. You know, if I were there at the time, knowing what I knew, I would say, well, that's what the Berlin crisis was about. Now you're offering the Soviets a very reasonable set of understandings. You were, you know, it's nice, clear, realist thinking, the way, you know, people like George Kennedy recommended. They should accept it, you know, wrap things up. You know, the whole threat of general thermonuclear war will recede. Soviets don't accept it. This is the extraordinary thing. They don't accept it. Right? And Khrushchev becomes very belligerent at Vienna, making all these threats. It's like, well, why? They see this shift in American policy. Why are the Americans being so reasonable now? Well, it's because they're scared of war. Well, if they're scared of war, let's ratchet up the risk of war, and who knows what additional concessions we'll be able to shake out of them. You know, I mean, you have to understand, Khrushchev is not a sophisticated statesman. This, okay. So Kennedy goes back, and he says, well, they're pushing us in a corner. They're threatening they're going to bring the Berlin thing to a head by the end of the year. We got to prepare ourselves for it because we are not going to capitulate. He comes back, gives this great speech to the country. You know, we got to get ready for war. We got to build fallout shelters. We got to, you know, build up our armed forces and so on. You know, rousing speeches in July of 61. Very different from Eisenhower. Eisenhower deliberately refrained from this kind of talk. And now it's the turn of the Soviets that get scared. What do they do? Following month, August of 61, they build the Berlin Wall. They seal off the two parts of Berlin and thus the two parts of Germany for the first time. Why is this important? Because it means that they're essentially throwing in the towel on Berlin. If you're looking for something that would symbolize their acceptance of a divided Europe, a divided Germany, of a divided Berlin, you couldn't ask for anything better than a wall. Right? They are basically accepting the division of Berlin, meaning the Western presence in West Berlin. You know, meaning that all of their threats about Berlin, they're putting on hold. Right? But we do not interpret the building of the Berlin Wall in those terms. We don't, breathe a huge sigh of relief and say, well, you know, we brought matters to a head and now they've given way. We interpret this Berlin Wall thing as a big defeat for us. Soviets are behaving unilaterally. This is just the beginning of future unilateral actions. They're, you know, they're kind of you know, thumbing their noses at us and so on. Who knows what's going to happen? And this leads not to a greater degree of intransigence on American policy, but to the Americans practically falling over themselves to kind of try and reach for a settlement, making yet additional concessions. So much so that even the British, who are very moderate in this whole Berlin business, are a little upset by how far the Americans are willing to go, and to go on a unilateral basis. There's a document from President Kennedy in this period basically saying that we're going to move ahead with this regardless of what the Europeans think. That they'll either, and this is a direct quote, either have to come along or fall behind. But we're moving ahead. Okay. But all of these concessions do not have the desired effect of getting the Soviets to close the deal. We sum up our basic thinking about the nature of the settlement. Basically, you know, the core of this is we're going to keep West Germany non-nuclear. In exchange for that, the Soviets are going to respect the Western position in West Berlin. We don't phrase in those terms. It's phrased in terms of our interest in non-diffusion of nuclear weapons. But it's like it's clear Germany's the target. And it's all summed up in a very important document laying out the overall American view that's presented to the Soviets in March of 1962. This is called the Principles Document. Very, very important in the history of this thing. That's the thrust of American policy. This is not an easy policy to pursue, partly because of this whole problem with the Soviets. The more concessions you make, the more they treat it as a sign of weakness, the harder their position becomes. You can't, it's very hard to wrap it up in a purely peaceful way. But that's not the end of the story, because we also have to deal with the Europeans. This is what I call this kind of war on two fronts where we have to fight. We got to get the Soviets to go along with it, but we also have to get the Europeans to go along with it. And this new Kennedy policy leads to a crisis in the Atlantic Alliance, probably the greatest crisis in the alliance that there ever was. I mean, frankly, you look at the history of NATO, and you point to any year at random and say, oh, here is a crisis there, there's a crisis there. I actually once assembled this whole list of books and articles about NATO, and it's like, any, you know, 1961, disarray in the alliance, 1962, an alliance, you know, the crisis in the alliance, and so these problems are endemic to NATO. They're chronic. But this was a particularly serious one. Why? Because this whole policy that Kennedy had, centralizing control in Washington, was bound to upset the Europeans, especially since they had misgivings about the substance of American policy. You know, Americans it was practically a policy of appeasement. Look at all these concessions the Americans are making. Look at the effect it's having on the Soviets. It's not bringing them around. Okay? This crisis in the alliance. What is the American policy? It has a big military component. Basically, we want to centralize control over nuclear weapons and over NATO strategy in the United States, in the hands of the political authorities in Washington, not just in the hands of this American general in Europe, but in the hands of the political authorities in Washington. And meaning that the Europeans will not be allowed to use their nuclear forces independently. And this policy is reflected in a whole series of actions on, in various areas that I've kind of summed up there with these acronyms. C-cubed, what does that mean? Command, control, and communications. Basically, it's we've got to tighten up the control system for the use of nuclear weapons so that they can't be used without, you know, codes being released and a political decision being made in Washington. Big investment in this sort of thing. We're tightening up, preventing non-authorized use. PALs. You know what PALs are? They're permissive action links. They have these locks that you put on nuclear weapons to prevent unauthorized use. And so we're making sure that these nuclear weapons that are deployed in Europe, the continent of Europe, are locked with these PALs. And it's not because we think all nuclear weapons should be controlled in this way, because the equivalent weapons on American naval vessels, for example, are not subject to the PAL. SACUR. You recall how under Eisenhower, SACUR, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, the NATO commander, had independent authority to order the use of nuclear weapons. It was pre-delegated authority. The pre-delegation business was an important part of the strategy as it evolved in the 1950s. Now, SACUR's wings are clipped. SACUR's independent authority is cut back. He's ratcheted back to the level of a ordinary American field commander. Okay, and in fact, when the NATO commander, General Norstad, resists this, and Norstad had very good relations with the Europeans, very top-notch general, he resisted these efforts. He was basically forcibly retired. Basically fired. You know, all these things, I should say, they're noticed by the European governments. MRBMs. That stands for medium-range ballistic missiles. These are rockets that you deploy on the continent of Europe, capable of hitting targets within the Soviet Union. Norstad, for military reasons, wanted to deploy these things. And it makes a certain degree of military sense. Just like when the Soviets deployed missiles in Cuba in 1962, we knew that would affect our ability to threaten to invade Cuba. Because in the event we invade, the chances of those weapons actually being launched would be greater than they would have been if they were deployed, say, on Soviet territory. And so the physical deployment of strategic nuclear weapons on the territory of a country tends to deter an attack on that country. That's why they wanted these MRBMs. Plus, land-based weapons, if they're launched from the land, they can be targeted much more accurately than weapons that are launched from submarines, because, you know, the ocean shakes and stuff like that. They eventually solved that problem. But still, there were good military reasons for deploying MRBMs. Key decision that was made in the early Kennedy period is we're not going to go along with that plan. No MRBMs in Europe, because we're afraid that if we deploy them there, then the host country can take them over. And the MLF, multilateral force, as opposed to a land-based MRBM force, we're going to have these sea-based weapons under joint control. And in fact, the use of these weapons would be subject to an American veto. You know, it's like Kennedy thought, what does this give the Europeans over and above what they presently have? This does not give them the ability to use nuclear weapons without an American okay. And so it doesn't provide them with any additional security. But people feel like, oh, it's symbolic importance. We've got to do this. So they embrace this MLF. British and French nuclear weapons. Under Eisenhower, we had helped the British, and we were kind of wanted to help the French, and would have done it if de Gaulle, the French president, had been more cooperative with other aspects of policy and wasn't constantly thumbing his nose at the United States. Now under Kennedy, we turn not just against German nuclear weapons, but against British and French nuclear weapons as well. Because how can you say no to the Germans if you're saying yes to the French? But if you say no to the French, how can you go on saying yes to the British? So the only way we could support a policy of saying no nuclear weapons for Germany is by saying no nuclear weapons for anybody, not even the British and the French, because we don't want to come across as discriminating against the Germans. The Germans will never accept being singled out in that way. So we have to turn against all the Europeans having nuclear weapons. Nuclear doctrine, this is another important thing. You know, it's a big myth if you read the literature on this period. And this is about, there's an important shift in American nuclear doctrine from Eisenhower to Kennedy. Under Eisenhower, the strategy had been massive retaliation. Under Kennedy, they had a much more reasonable strategy, a flexible response, in which, in the event of war, you wouldn't just shoot off all your nuclear weapons all at once, and that was it. You know, under Kennedy, they would gradually escalate. They would use massive conventional forces first. It turns out that all of this is based on a caricature of the Eisenhower policy. The Eisenhower policy had never been to rule out the use of conventional forces. To take the case of Berlin, if the communists stop a U.S. military convoy on the Autobahn going from West Germany to West Berlin, the strategy was never, okay, that means war, execute the war plans, wipe out the Soviet Union. That was never the policy. It was policy of escalation up to the level of a reinforced division. Under Kennedy, they would go a little further. You know, they would go use a full army corps, which is like three divisions. You know, but fundamentally, the policy was not all that different than Kennedy under Eisenhower. On the nuclear level, the Kennedy administration embraced this official policy of controlled nuclear escalation. Controlled nuclear escalation meant in the event of war, and if matters reached the point of cross the nuclear threshold, instead of us having one and only one option, namely all-out nuclear attack, we would use nuclear weapons in a much more discriminate and selective way. Our goal would be to focus on the other side's strategic forces. We would try and wipe out their missiles and their bombers, right? While leaving their cities intact. We would want to reduce collateral damage, you know, in this nuclear attack. Why? Because by leaving their cities intact, they would have this strong incentive to refrain from retaliating against us with whatever they had left, for fear that the Americans would retaliate to that attack by destroying the USSR's own cities. So we want to leave their cities intact as hostages. And so, you know, it seems like a sophisticated doctrine, right? There's the doctrine laid out by Secretary of State McNamara in these two important speeches he gave in the spring of 1962. You know, the McNamara Doctrine was called, discriminate nuclear war, no cities doctrine. It turns out that none of this stuff was reflected in the war plans. The war plans weren't changed at all. These people in the Kennedy administration didn't believe in the idea of protracted nuclear war, discriminate nuclear war. They were not building weapons and designing weapons to execute this sort of strategy. And they didn't take any of this stuff terribly seriously. I remember being stunned. They released a whole bunch of tapes of conversations between Kennedy and his top advisors. And Kennedy, McNamara, and his National Security Advisor Bundy, they're treating all this stuff like it's big joke, you know, these different nuclear doctrines and how they're changing them all the time. They basically believe that nuclear weapons have no political utility beyond deterring their use by others. And all these doctrines are designed for political effect. What is the political effect of talking about this? It's a rationale for centralized control. Better let the Americans control the way war runs its course, because these doctrines, they'll be messed up if the British and the French are able to use the nuclear weapons independently. Let the Americans do everything, right? It's important because the Europeans don't like this one bit. And this is one of the things that leads to this crisis in NATO that culminates in January of 1963. Right. Kennedy has to concern himself with this stuff, because whatever deal he works out with the Russians, you're going to have to get the Europeans to buy into it. He's prepared, ultimately, to bring the matter to a head with the Europeans. In other words, basically to say to them, you want us to defend us? You better do what we want, which is to sign on to this arrangement. But before he brings matters to a head with them, he first needs to have an agreement with the Soviets in the bag. And so this is why what happens in 1962-63 is so important. So finding it hard to close the deal with the Soviets. We present them this offer, embodied in the principles document, March of 62. It's like, you know, everything that they have a right to expect. We're accommodating their most fundamental security needs. And what are we asking in return? That they do the same thing for us, that they respect our right to be in West Berlin. And they won't do it. So they simply accept all the concessions we make, but they don't make any concessions of their own. And you go through the documents for the year 1962, and you just see the Americans getting more and more unhappy, in fact, enraged by this Soviet behavior. And what does it mean? It means that a showdown with these people is inevitable. We've gone the extra mile. We've tried very hard to reach a political understanding. They're absolutely intransigent. They won't do it. And if that's the case, better have it out with them sooner rather than later. And Kennedy says as much in September of 1962. Right? The Soviets have pretty much made it clear that the Berlin thing has not been resolved, that they are going to bring the Berlin thing to a head after the midterm elections in the United States, scheduled for November of 62. What Kennedy is worried about is that we're on the verge of losing our strategic edge. Don't forget, I told you how by the summer of 63 we had lost it, according to that report of that net evaluation subcommittee. Right? They see it coming. Given that it's coming, and if a showdown is inevitable, we want to have that showdown while we still have the upper hand in strategic terms. We don't want to wait until we've entered into a world of nuclear parity and we no longer enjoy strategic superiority. So the argument about America's closing window of vulnerability, which had previously been an argument for reaching a negotiated settlement and for making concessions, now the argument is turned on its head and it becomes an argument for taking a tough line, for bringing matters to a head while we still get our a nuclear edge. And that's the context for the Cuban Missile Crisis. That's why the Cuban Missile Crisis is important. It's not this kind of separate thing that just kind of happens. This is the Cuban Missile Crisis is an integral part of this great crisis over Berlin. It's the climax of the Great Berlin Crisis. Intimately related to it. Why? Because if we move against Cuba, the Soviets can easily retaliate, not against Cuba, but not in the Caribbean, but around Berlin. If we blockade Cuba, they could blockade Berlin. So we're forced to face up to the fact that if we take a tough line on Cuba, as we do, after we discover the missiles there, the Soviets may retaliate against Berlin. And we know, Kennedy says, the showdown with the Soviets over Berlin is coming inevitably, eventually. Better have it out now rather than later. The Cuban Missile Crisis, as you all know, is ended with a Soviet, not a capitulation, pure and simple, because certain concessions to them are made, but basically they give way. The whole Khrushchev policy is revealed as a bluff. And what this means is that the policy that they had embraced, symbolized by Khrushchev's Berlin threats, this is now bankrupt, discredited, and the path is open to a negotiated political settlement. And something like a negotiated political settlement is reached in the year 1963, and that's what I'm going to be talking about next time. Okay? Thanks.